ตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอภารุธาเดสังมัทสะทวราเยโสรวันธาบามุญจันทุสัทธาThis is the observance nights, and it's very auspicious to have Ajahn Sajito and his monks and nuns here for this time, for this week. To support and help each other, encourage each other in practice, Dharma practice, in the monastic life. As Kalyana Mitas, the value of Sangha is that it's encouragement, support, underlying support, common goal, common aspiration, common tradition and form that we all use. Our Dhamma Vinaya, our tradition, is something that we all have in common, something that we can use to reflect our oftentimes the glaring differences in terms of character, personality, nationality, etc. All the things that we can dwell on that are different. Though it's important to recognize the common bond, that which binds us together as a Samana Sangha. And these days there's so many, in the Buddhist world, in the West, there's so many people have so many views and opinions about monastics, monks, nuns, lay people, lay teachers, whether you need to go all the way and become a monk or a nun, or whether you can become enlightened without becoming a monk or a nun, or what is it, all these kind of speculations. People are interested in wanting to know how to do it. How to get enlightened, or how to be liberated from suffering, or realize Nibbana, salvation, liberation, freedom. All these words imply an ultimate realization in which we break through the delusions that we have about ourselves and the world that we live in. And the Buddha's direct pointing at the problem is the basic delusion we have, the avicca, the ignorance of the suffering, its causes, the ignorance of the cessation of suffering, ignorance of the Eightfold Path. And this is what, when we use the word avicca, it implies this kind of ignorance. Doesn't mean ignorance of in other ways, like not knowing things about worldly situations. But this having not explored, investigated, contemplated, reflected, not having with insight penetrated the truth of the way it is, then our relationship to the world, to each other, to the tradition or to the society will always be a source of suffering for us. because this realm that we're in is a realm of it's a very painful realm to be born into. This basically being human being on planet Earth is the experience of sensation. It's sensitive. It's painful. We have to live with so many, so much pain and anguish and despair, grief, loss, separation from the loved, having to put up with, having to bear with irritations, aggravations, frustrations, miserable situations. This is the aging process the body goes through, and the varieties of pain and sickness, disease, death, and all this is a part of this realm. It's the experience that we have when we're living in this realm as human beings. So this is kind of normal. There's nothing. We're not. I'm not complaining about it. I'm not saying it should be any other way. But we're recognizing that it's this way. This is the way it is. That as long as we seek to attach and identify with this realm that we're living in, with the body we have, or with the feelings, with the perceptions, mental formations, with consciousness, when we attach, identify, and believe that these are ourselves, and of course we create more suffering around the natural suffering that we experience, the natural unsatisfactoriness that is conveyed in the nature of the conditioned realm. So when we investigate this realm that we're living in, it means we're not looking at it in terms of making value judgments or trying to complain about it or to think that we can somehow transform the conditioned realm into something that would be permanently better, permanently more beautiful, permanently more pleasurable. Then we realize that in the, say, in Western Europe, the past 50 years, there's been enormous effort put forth in trying to create that kind of experience, kind of materialist world of luxury and stability, materialism, pleasure-seeking, hedonism, goes into all kinds of extremities. And yet, even at its very best, when you do have the very best of it all, is something basically unsatisfying. It can't really fulfill us. Also, we have an aspiration towards the ultimate realization, the basic religious impulse of human beings that is common to us all in every form of every human being that was ever born has some kind of intuitive feeling that somehow there's more to it than just this singular existence that we're experiencing as this individual. And the mystery, the unknown that we sense, there's something more, something magnificent, something marvelous in this universe, where our lives can get really involved with just the just trying to survive, just trying to get enough food, or just barely eke out a living, trying to make our way with it, trying to control the pain, the disease, the sense of loss, the fear of the future, the fear of death. We're just grinding ourselves into just an endless kind of survival creature. that gets depressed, disappointed, lost in our lives to become very meaningless and purposeless. So we oftentimes take to drink or drugs, something that at least kind of give us a break from the endless proliferations we make around through negativity, through fear and desire, through doubt and worry, anxiety, through self-consciousness, obsessions with ourselves, through blaming, through fear of being blamed, and all the rest that the wars, the persecution, the atrocities, the endless quarrels that we see, we experience, we hear about. Just in this century, the 20th century, there's been a century of just, one war, one conflict after another. Conflicts that are really, called world wars. First, second world war, the Cold War, and plus all the innumerable conflicts that go on that don't get such kind of extreme labels. They get called police actions or coup d'etats or whatever, but whatever you want to call it, it is a form of misery. And now I don't know how many wars are going on at this time on this planet. There are a lot. And what are these caused from? Why do we seek to solve problems or try to create a society that we think we can maybe make better or have some idea that it will get better if we get our way, if we win the battle through these violent means, through deceit, through violence, through abuse, atrocity, murder and slaughter and so forth. And we think we can somehow, if we can hope to create some kind of idyllic society through such means. But in the monastic life, we're looking at the internal war that goes on in the mind. And so the conflicts that arise, let's say, in one's own mind in daily life. Because we have, we have ideas about how things should be. We have, we would like everything to be harmonious and everybody to be honest and everybody to be helpful, courteous, thoughtful, respectful, good, generous, moral, and the society to be like this, and the world we live in. We'd like ourselves to kind of live up to these high-minded ideals, these high standards, and yet emotionally, we can feel just the opposite. We can feel mean, selfish, critical. We can be endlessly blaming ourselves, blaming others, deceiving ourselves, getting caught in very gross forms of desire and so forth. So that we have conflicts going on inside our mind. I used to find it very difficult before I understood what was going on, because I had high aspirations and high standards and ideals for my life, and yet it always seemed to be pulled down by my emotions, caught in very kind of immature reactions or very selfish or very unkind emotional habits. And yet, ideally, I didn't want that. I wanted to be kind, generous, good, and all the rest. So then you end up with this judging going on, the intellect judging, the thinking, the emotions are bad, or you shouldn't, there's something wrong with me for having, feeling like this, for having these thoughts, for having these emotions. So there's a critic, you know, saying, this is bad, you're a bad person for thinking like this, feeling like this. And so the conflict goes on, you try to justify it, you rationalize all kinds of things, you manage to deceive yourself a good part of the time, but this confusion arises, endless confusion, emotional confusion, and one just feels a sense of despair, hopelessness with oneself, through trying to solve one's emotional problems through the intellect, or just trying to suppress the emotions, try to deny or refuse to acknowledge them. Monastic life can be just based on an ideal, you know, just trying to be a good monk, a good nun, and trying to live up to the standards, the ideals that we read about in the scriptures. And that will take us so far into the inspirational states of mind, because we long to aspire to being a really good monk or really good nun. And then we're sometimes shocked and disgusted by our own emotional reactions or desires, low, selfish, animalistic desires that we also identify with and try to get rid of and deny. So in the Buddha, to solve this dilemma, used mindfulness as the means. So mindfulness is sati, is a kind of the key word. For Buddha's teaching. And when we're practicing meditation, then we're using the intuitive ability of the mind. We're not rationalizing or analyzing anything, even though we can use those when necessary. But meditation isn't an analysis or a rationalization or a critique or a suppression or a denial of anything, but the willingness to embrace the moment, because the intuition is the ability that we have when we're receptive and fully awake and aware in the present. So when this two lines of Pali that I chant after the Namo Tassa, the gates to the deathless are open, this has been my theme song since I came to Amaravati 13 years ago. As many of you know, that's the theme song of Amaravati, the gates to the deathless are open. Amaravati is the deathless realm. And this, of course, metaphor. Don't think that the actual plot of land. But it's also to use this to remind ourselves that the gate, the doors, the entrance to the deathless are open. Then for those who listen, who pay attention, so the sotawanta is the ability, is one who listens. One who listens or sees or pays attention is awake. And it's not paying attention to a condition like reading a book particularly, but it's this ability to be awake and aware in the present. To put that kind of effort into the present moment to sustain this awareness, to listen, which is an expansive state of mind, isn't it? The conscious experience in the present is embracing the moment rather than discriminating, like concentrating on one thing, and shutting out all the rest.
like with samatha meditation, we tend to do that. We tend to concentrate on one thing and sharpen up the concentration through suppression. Then with vipassana, we're using this intuition, which is intuitive awareness, which is to embrace the present, the totality of it, the way it is. Then the sota-vanta bhamunjantu satang, to trust, to relax into this present moment with faith. Sada bhamunjantu is to kind of release or let go, relax into with faith. Just your ability, simple. It's a simple ability. It's not a complicated, difficult thing to do. Not like you have to spend years trying to be mindful and trying to get it. It's not like that. It's a natural state that is relaxed and attentive, open, receptive in the present. So then when we trust in that, then we begin to recognize the way it is. For example, in the Satipatthana, the body, the feelings, the mental formations, the Dhamma, the four foundations of mindfulness. So this is what's present here and now, isn't it? In every moment now, that here and now, the present, Pachubanna Dhamma, is what's now for as experience in the present, is the body, isn't it? We're all experiencing the body now. How do you experience your body? You know, if you analyze it through conceiving it as this and that, through the various kind of ways that we have, say, with medical terminologies or scientific terms, that's one way of trying to analyze the body as if it in an abstract way, through looking at charts, through looking at books on anatomy and physiology, or through intuition, isn't it? When we just open and observe the way the body is in the present, like this. So that's an intuitive ability where the mind is embracing or with the way the body is. It's intuitive awareness rather than rational analysis. It's like this. And so they use the four postures, the breath. The breath is like this. Sitting, standing, walking, lying down, like this. We're not. It's not criticizing or saying, you know, saying how it should be, but whatever way it is, whether you're walking straight or crooked, sitting erect or hunched over, whether you're feeling pleasure or pain, or whatever, it's not really. We're not having a standard that we're trying to make ourselves live up to, but just noticing. Beginning to trust in our ability to just observe the way it is, like this. So in that moment, and the body is seen for what it is, and our relationship to it has changed from seeing it from the sense of my body, as we might look at it in a mirror with vanity, you know, and how attractive or how old do I look, my complexion, and so forth. Or seeing the body merely in terms of the perceptions of modern science, and through analyzing it and criticizing it. Or through feeling it, being with it. Because the experience of consciousness in this present moment allows us, gives us this ability to let the body be a conscious experience in the present because of this intuitive ability of the mind. And then the Vedanupassana is the Vedana, feeling, pleasure, pain, sukha, dukkha, dukkha matsukha Vedana. Because this is a sense experience, and of pleasure, pain, and neutral sensation through the senses, through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. The mind, mental stage, give us pleasure or pain or are neutral, as well as sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. So we're now intuiting feeling or Vedana, meaning we're not judging it, criticizing it, but just noticing it's like this. Pleasure is like this. Pain is like this. Neutral sensations like this. Or in through the eye, you know, pleasure. When we look at beauty, pleasure is like this. Attraction, isn't it? When we see something beautiful, we feel this pull towards it. We feel attracted. Attraction is like this. When we look at something ugly, repulsive, repulsion is like this. Dukkha Vedana. Then neither pleasure nor pain is like this. And so it's the way it is. We're not making this up. We're not trying to fit experience into ideas we have about it or so-called Buddhist ideas. We're actually observing in a state of awareness the way it is. And in the Jitanupassana, Saripatthana, the mental state, the mood, the state of mind, the jitta is like this. Whether it's you feeling inspired or depressed or expanded or contracted or elated or frightened or angry or greedy, jealous, envious, doubtful, uncertain, confused, miserable, stressed out, whatever the jitta is like, it's also intuiting that by the intuitive awareness allows us to recognize this is the way it is, but it's not judging it. This is particularly, I find particularly a challenge to deal with Jitanupassana, because you say you're having you're feeling angry or you're feeling uncertain or confused. There's so much resistance wanting to get rid of it and change it. But we began to, through this Bamunjandu Sadang, by releasing, letting go into the present moment. We're not trying to make anything out of it, just let it be what it is. It's like this. So miserable mental state is like this. Then Dhammanupassana Satipatthana. This takes us to the ultimate realization, where we realize the Dhamma is like this. The Amata Dhamma, the deathless, is like this. The conditioned realm is anicca, dukkha, anatta. So we see that we use these as reminders of the way it is, not as ideas we put on to life. And I think this is one of the problems with vipassana, as Westerners tend to practice it, is that they tend to project these the idea of impermanence onto everything, or suffering, or unsatisfactoriness, so that they're really conditioning their mind to see everything through their projection rather than trusting in their ability to just observe. So anicca, dukkha, anatta, these three characteristics of existence, aren't positions we take in order to interpret experience, but they're reminders, help us to remember, to observe these characteristics as they're happening now. Remember the old wet blanket approach we used to do years ago. You know, you say, look at a flower and you say, that flower is beautiful. Then we say, yeah, but it's impermanent. It's going to get old soon and wilt and then turn rotten and stink. And they think that's vipassana. which is, you know, kind of, the way I said that was deliberately said in a state of projecting this, that you shouldn't enjoy beauty because you'll get attached and then you'll suffer. So you start looking at even beauty as through some projection of suffering. You know, it's all miserable, which leads to a kind of self-delusion. Again, it's depressing. But this isn't mindfulness. This is just trying to convince yourself of something, something you call Buddhism. So, we're not trying to convince ourselves, but observing that beauty is attractive. It's the way it is. It's like this. It's not making any value judgment about it. Beauty is impermanent. You know, it's not nothing. That's part of this. That's fine. It's nothing. Unless the only suffering you have is when you want beauty to be permanent, then you create suffering around beauty. Misery and pain is impermanent, but it tends to seem permanent. Like when you're in pain, it tends to seem like, you know, one is always afraid it's going to last forever. The idea of a hell realm isn't where you're permanently in chronic pain, miserable pain that will last forever is the kind of mental state that you have when there's a real pain, physical pain or physical discomfort, or even mental pain. But with intuitive awareness, then the mind is in this receptive state, non-critical state of embracing the present, the pain or the ugliness or the pleasure or the beauty. And our response to it then is through accepting it for what it is. It's like this. And we say the way it is. It's like this. It's not, there's no judgment in that. It's just, it's a way of say, reflecting on it, just to not make any judgments about it. Pleasure feels like this. So you start looking, start accepting the pleasure you're feeling, but not indulging in it. You're really aware of it. It's like pleasure is like this. Pain is like this. Neutral sensations like this. In the silence of the mind, then where the world and eternity meet, as Father Panikkara says in those texts. The silence is where the world and the eternity meet. Well, that's an interesting reflection for me. Well, I've contemplated that a lot. Because in the present moment, you know, one can be very much aware of the world or the emotion or the state of mind, the agitated mental state that one is experiencing, or the physical sensations of the body. And when that dominates all our attention, then we have no way of then it just goes on and on to the next one. You know, the world, the samsara has this kind of endless cycle feeling to it. It just goes around and around and around. And so as long as one's attention is only on the rupa, gaya, vedana, ditta, one is just continually kind of processing conditioned experience, and it just goes, one goes, thing goes on to the next. So in realizing the deathless, realizing in the third noble truth, realizing of Nirodha, of Nibbana, realization of anatta, like sape tama anatta, and when you chant that, all dhamma is anatta. Realizing anatta, non-self, sunyata, emptiness, realizing nirodha, cessation, realizing nibbana, non-attachment. So intuition is the ability to embrace the world and eternity in the present. Now that sounds pretty grand, doesn't it, in terms of terminology. But through reflecting on it, you know, that isn't such a rare or impossible thing to do. I mean, when you think of it in terms of maybe abstract thinking and your intellectual abilities, it does sound difficult. But in terms of experience, it's quite normal, natural thing to be able to do. In that, the gate to the deathless are open. So in that state of attention, attentive awareness, intuitive awareness. That's the entrance, or that's the point. That's the intersection where time and the timeless. And that's what we're able to realize in this human form, within the limitations of our humanity. We can actually realize and learn to trust in that still point in the present, which paradoxically, as they say, the point that has no boundaries. So it's like a point is a dot, and then but it has no circumference. It's unlimited, and that's where we give up the thinking, kind of analytical mind, trying to figure that one out, and experience it, realize it through its mindfulness way of contemplating and way of opening to life. Meditation in Buddhist terms isn't a shutting down and trying to control and trying to kind of filter out all the coarse, unpleasant things and trying to kind of support all that's refined in our lives, but it's willing to flow with life, because with intuitive awareness, we no longer feel the need to control experience. If we're caught in just the worldly dhammas, then there is a need to control things. We always, because we just get so upset or so confused or so angry or so resentful or so disturbed by this or that we do have to control. And exert a lot of effort to just try to survive in the world, because it's just too frightening, too many aggravations, too many frustrations in it. But with the enlightened mind, then the mind doesn't need to control, because it's no longer something that we're stuck in just going from one thing to the next. and we have the escape, then this, there is an escape. This is my one of my favorite quotes. I think it's from the from what? Which one is it? The Udana? Or, anyway, the there is an escape from the born, the creator, the originator. And so that is the world, isn't it? The world, the body, the feelings, the mental states, and all that. There's an escape from that. The word escape doesn't mean escape in out of aversion. Doesn't mean we hate the world and we're just trying to get out of it. It's not based on aversion or blaming the world. It's not that kind of escape. But it's the escape through wisdom, through seeing the nature of this is like this. And that as long as we're bound into the conditioned realm, identified, attached, lost in it, then all the best we can do is try to control it for our own benefit. You know, exert and make lots of money and try to buy a nice cottage in some pleasant place and try to, you know, avoid any unpleasant scenes or unpleasant people or pollution and all that. You can so instead of having to do that, mm-hmm. say the samana, when we look at our lives here as mendicants, which means that we lose a ability to control everything, don't we? We don't have any money. We have to just accept alms food, and we've given up our ability to control our lives. And kind of arrange and manipulate conditions for our own benefit, protect ourselves. You're at the mercy, in that we're at the mercy of the society we're in, whether the society is merciful or merciless. Fortunately, the society is fairly merciful. So we have this nice temple now, you can sit, and good food every day, and all the rest of it. This is the mercy. Now we're living in a merciful society rather than a merciless one. But we're dependent on the mercy of this society for the basic survival, for the four requisites. So that means we're deliberately choosing not to be in control of all that and taking the risk of meeting mercilessness, hard-heartedness, brutality, indifference, not caring, not respecting. No reason why anybody should just respect us, respect me because I'm Buddhist monk, especially in a non-Buddhist country. But the fact is that it does. It's never been a problem for me living in Britain because there is mercy, there is good-heartedness, that samana life does seem to bring out the goodness in others. Brings out these merciful virtues. So then we listen, our kind of occupation then, as someone does, is not just to survive on alms food and all the rest. This is an end in itself. That takes care of the kind of basics of the necessities that we have to have, something to eat, you know, something to wear, roof over the head, and medicine for illness. But then we have now the occasion, the opportunity, not to just, we don't have to spend our lives just kind of trying to survive at a low level, or having to support ourselves, but live in a simple way, simplify our life, and develop the meditation, bhavana, cultivation, which is learning to relax and listen, pay attention, both internally and externally. And externally we're observing, not criticizing or making judgments about I like this, I don't like that, but observing the way things are. And then internally, we can observe our own kind of fears and desires, our way our conceit operates, the way our you know, various emotions arise and cease. And we can explore our own mind. We become aware of the edge where the thinking stops, thinking ceases. So I used to, you know, did a lot of investigation of this, where the thinking ceases, and really used or developed all kinds of upayas or skillful means to deal with, to learn how to recognize, realize where there's no thought. Because then I can, when the thinking ceases, my feelings, my moods, making judgments, my intellectual mind's programmed to endlessly criticize my moods, my emotions, my habits. And so if I have no cessation of thought, then all I can do is try to kind of rationalize my existence as a monk, which isn't liberating. Isn't the experience of liberation. So the aim to recognize, first of all, I recognize the cessation of thought. We were talking this afternoon at tea time about doubt, and investigating the state of not knowing, the experience of not knowing, not understanding, doubting, uncertainty. Where the thinking process ceases, and suddenly you're aware of non-thinking is like this. The gaps between thoughts, the gaps between words. So, then also I use this sound of silence, develop this one, found very helpful. And many of you are using this now. I hope to good effect. But it also is a sign where the thinking mind ceases, where you're at the edge, where the conditioning of the mind is no longer, you're no longer caught in the conditioning of the mind. And where you can, and as you rest into that sound of silence, more relax into that silence, then you can really know what you're feeling. You know, this is the level of citta that you're experiencing in the present. Whether you're feeling the mood is happy or sad or pleasant or painful, whatever, confused. Like intuitive awareness allows you to, like confusion, where I was saying the other day about having this one afternoon fairly recently, this feeling, this strong emotion, and I had this, and my intellect was busily trying to kind of analyze this emotion, and trying to kind of, you know, making judgments about my emotional state. And then the emotion was like this. So just embracing both the intellectual desire to figure it out and the actual feeling of that emotion, and the result was confusion. And so as I stayed with the confusion, then the confusion dropped, and you're aware of the cessation. So you're realizing the cessation of emotional habits, not getting rid of them or suppressing them, but with being aware when they're no longer present, no longer there. So mindfulness is a factor that isn't going up and down with the conditions that you're experiencing. And that's why we have this refuge in this awareness. It's the Buddha, knowing the Dhamma, isn't it? The ability to pay attention to life as you're experiencing it, not as some abstraction, but as life is as it is, you know, whatever way it feels for you, because that's the world as far as the experience goes, is what you're thinking, what you're feeling. Whether it's crazy or sane or sensible or stupid or whatever, we're not judging it. We just notice it's like this. So there is the escape from the created, the conditioned, the born, the originated. Because there is the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated. So that's realization. It's not a Buddhist philosophical theory. It's realizable. It's reality, in other words. Now I'd ask myself monastic life over the years, I said, this has to be something practical. It just can't, you know, like the oftentimes religious teachings get exalted to the point where you feel you no longer can make them work. And so Nibbana is one of those words in the Buddhist world that gets exalted, gets put up on a pedestal, and arahants and sotapannas and all these are put on pedestals so that they're so high that most of us think they're just beyond our ability. But then, is that what the Buddha was teaching? Worshipping something on a pedestal? That we have faith in something up on a pedestal? Is that what he was teaching? Then any religion, you know, golden idols, or you might as well worship, you know, beautiful golden goddesses on pedestals, something. if you're into worshiping things on pedestals, but Nibbana isn't something refined, but it's subtle. So it's asking us to pay attention rather than to refine ourselves. The realization of the cessation, how does that work in practical, as a practical thing in your life? And so I'd try to, you know, witness that the cessation that goes on in my mind, the way things end in my mind. And I notice when I really pay attention, and it's easy enough to see with with words, with thoughts. His thought moves quite quickly. Or I develop these deliberate thoughts, you know, and then think in a deliberate way so I can observe the gaps, the interstices, spaces between thoughts, between words, and the end. But then the emotions kind of linger, don't they? They hang around. They have a lot of inertia. They don't move so quickly. So you're stuck with oftentimes moods, with feelings in your mind, in your body, in your heart, feeling of sadness or despair or resentment. So then the intuitive awareness of that feeling is like this. And you go right into the feeling, totally embracing the emotional feeling, not judging it, analyzing it, but just letting it be like this. Like grief, for example, sense of the loss of somebody you love. It's like this. And when my mother died, I really explored that sense of loss. It's like this. Rather than just trying to smother the emotion or ignore it, I really determined to grieve, to really know this feeling, embrace the whole emotion of grief. And then through that, then it naturally ceased. It wasn't repressed or forced. And I realized the cessation of a condition. I witnessed, I was there when it ended. So that's putting it into practical, and then into practical realizations. Nothing fantastic or all that difficult about it. Just your willingness to do that, and your trust, your confidence that you can do that. And then recognizing when grief ceased, there is peace. Like when that emotion was when it had finished, then there was a sense of this real peacefulness, bliss. Not a kind of blissed out high, but this lovely feeling of emptiness, no self. Non-attachment. And recognize, realizing it's like that. Non-attachment is like this. So you're really informing your conscious life with wisdom all the time. Both in the presence, with the presence of the condition, the attachment to the condition, and the absence and non-attachment of the condition. No both, not no preference. We get greedy. I just want to live in the state of nibbana, non-attachment, and emptiness. And we attach, you know, we attach the idea of emptiness and to the memories maybe we've had of those moments. That doesn't work either, because as far as our karma goes, we're like this. We're at that point of intersection. The world, the conditioned realm, is very strong experience for us, having a physical body like this, having senses and all the rest. You know, this is what we have to accept, the world, the conditioned realm as it is. not try to escape from it because we don't like it and don't want to suffer and don't want to feel it and don't want to experience it anymore, but recognize it, realize it, its presence, and also recognize, realize non-attachment to it. When there's attachments like this, when there's non-attachment, it's like this. With meditation too, there's so many theories and views and types and that about it. And oftentimes we make it sound so difficult and so like years and years of hard work and sacrifice. If that's what we think, then that's probably what we'll experience. We create that, don't we? That's the world we create. That we're, and then we tend to, that's what we tend to experience then. But it's not either, getting enlightened quickly and then any position you take, you can be aware of. Even, we can even attach to the view of not being attached. You shouldn't be attached to anything, people say. And then we're attached to that view. Or all the views about meditation, about samatha, you have to get this, then do vipassana, and then the pure vipassana, and views about all kinds of things that we... The views aren't necessarily the problem, it's the attachment. It's the commitment, the attachment, taking refuge in views that blind us. So even attachment to the view of non-attachment will blind you. So I used to try deliberately being attached to things just so I could realize and know what attachment like, and deliberately attach, instead of just saying, I shouldn't be attached, and kind of living my life in a kind of furtive way, don't dare attach. And I would experiment with my attachments, and really watch and feel them, and feel what it's like to really be attached to things or people or ideas. Really, like the attachment to the form or attachment to the tradition. How much suffering I created around my attachment to the tradition. To various members of the Sangha. The kind of attachment I had towards these things. And then, but observing the result of that attachment. And then through that, then you realize the suffering that comes through attachment. Your non-attachment isn't coming from just some idea that you shouldn't be attached, but it's through understanding that, when you grasp fire, it hurts. The actual experience of it, you naturally let go. Naturally don't attach to things that hurt when you know that they do. But if you don't know that, then even attachment to the best of the conditioned realm, attachment to Buddhism, attachment to monasteries, or attachment to traditions, methods, none of these things are the problem in themselves. It's the attachment, upadana, dana upadana, that is where we are most blind. You can see, never trust anybody that points to the condition. Don't attach to that view either. But you know what attachment is. What does it feel like to be obsessed, to be really attached to views or opinions or people or places? What does it feel like where you feel this obsession about them, compulsion, where you feel very anxious if they're ever threatened, or you feel angry, or you feel indignant, you feel jealous? You're worried, anxious about this and that because this changes, or this your pet, your favorite, your commitment, your everything is bound up in this, and it might be threatened, and you feel yourself going crazy with resentment or anger. That's attachment. That's the sign of attachment. And that very attachment isn't, we're not trying to get rid of it, but to understand it, know it, feel it, experience it. So then you know what you're talking about. You know, and then your letting go isn't through aversion or fear or about attachment. It's through understanding, realizing non-attachment is like this. Non-attachment is cool. It's joyful. I notice in monastic life, that I get a lot of joy from monastic life when there's no attachment to it. When I start attaching to anything in this monastic system, then I don't get much joy out of this life. I could blame a monastic life, or blame others. Then I know better. Know that if I'm experiencing monastic life as onerous or difficult or hard or whatever, then it's because of an attachment I have. Where is that? What am I attached to then that's making my life so joyless and so miserable? And then I try to see, investigate there. What am I attached to now that makes me suffer like this? So the next few days we have the opportunity to practice together and discuss practice or whatever it wants to do. What, till you're returning? What, Friday or Thursday night? We stay up till midnight. Night. You're all invited to participate.